Hi everyone, I'm Adam Johnson. I'm a dad and a rare disease patient advocate, a self-proclaimed dadvocate. From the onset of symptoms and even after an eventual diagnosis, the isolation was almost as excruciating as the symptoms themselves. I felt so alone in so many ways. One of the most prominent ways in particular was as a parent. I knew I couldn't be the only person with a rare disease who was also trying to raise children, but it sure felt like I was. As I've learned, when there's not a specific community you're looking for, one that you need, sometimes you just have to make it yourself. It's taken a while, but I finally decided to do just that. And here we are. This is Parents is Rare, a series brought to you by Energy in Action. Living life as a parent with a rare disease can be quite paradoxical. We laugh and cry, we're vulnerable and scared, we're brave and afraid, all at the same time. Parents is Rare is a community where parents like me who have a rare disease or chronic illness can connect, share, support, and be supported. Hey everyone, today I'm talking with Dr. Jennifer Young. Jenny doesn't have a rare disease herself, but she is a parent with a two-year-old at home who has a significant connection to the rare disease communities. Jenny is a trained marriage and family therapist. She's been doing research on families with rare genetic conditions for 7 years. Jenny's goal is to improve family coping, communication, and access to mental health resources in this population, especially for underserved groups. She's currently working as a postdoc at Stanford University in the Center for Biomedical Ethics, and she's a visiting scholar at Northwestern University in the Center for Genetic Medicine. As you'll find out, Jenny is a wealth of knowledge, a strong leader, and a rising star in the field. I thought she'd be a fabulous guest to have on the podcast to discuss these important topics, and she sure delivered. Please enjoy my conversation with Dr. Jennifer Young. Hey, Jenny, how are you?
Doing all right, Adam. How about yourself?
Pretty good. Pretty good. The sun's shining today here in Idaho, so that's a nice welcome reprieve after all this inversion stuff that we have. Traps the grossness into the valley. Yeah.
I know. We have had mountains of snow this week, and today was the first time we saw blue skies in a while, so I'm feeling good today. Yeah.
Fantastic. Savor those moments, right? I love it. Well, thanks for taking some time to join me today on the Parents is Rare podcast, and I'm excited to dive in with you and talk a little bit about some of the topics that we're going to discuss here. But before we get too far, I was wondering if you wouldn't mind just sharing a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So I'm a marriage and family therapist by training. I have a PhD in an area called family science, which is basically the study of family relationships within the systems and the systems in which they exist and their contexts. And I became really interested. My mom was actually a genetics researcher, and I became really interested in families and genetics, and did a fellowship at the National Cancer Institute at the clinical genetics branch there. So that's when I was really introduced to families with rare diseases. And specifically, most of my work has been around families with rare genetic conditions. So I worked in the kind of cancer genetic space for a little while. And moving on to Stanford, I've been working really closely with the Undiagnosed Diseases Network there. And a lot of my research is really doing in-depth interviews with families, which sometimes kind of feels like therapy, to be honest, both for myself and for them. But my end goal with this kind of work is just to try to build awareness about how challenging it is on a family level for people, for individuals, for their relationships, and also to kind of try to build up some awareness amongst mental health care providers as well about what we can do to try to address these families' unique needs. I feel like there are not enough people with this kind of a little bit more medical expertise just to be able to work with families that have these ongoing conditions and kind of ups and downs in their lives. Yeah, so that's what I've been working on. And I think my favorite part about my job is interfacing and working with the people, with you, Adam, and yeah, your family.
Fantastic. Well, I love the work that you're doing. It's great to hear about the background. I didn't realize the connection with your mom. I was wondering about some of the, you know, the background there. So you did the family science degree for your PhD, and you did the couples and family therapy for your MS, right? So that was really kind of inspired by some of the work that your mom did?
Indeed. Indeed it was. I was always really interested in biology and genetics. And this was kind of, I think I really love being a therapist, but I think there are bigger healthcare system issues that often influence the work that we do. And so I wanted my work to kind of take a bigger scope and more of a health focus. So that's why I went into that field.
And what a natural partnership that I agree with you from what you said earlier, a little bit disconnected at times, right? It feels as such. And I know that I've talked to and interacted with many other folks in the rare disease community, the chronic illness community, where we're looking for some helps, for some support, specifically on the mental health side. But when the mental health side is, I don't know if neglecting is too strong of a word, but in some instances, it's just not there for, you know, the family health side, the family science side, the mental health side. And there's just this disconnect, and it's really challenging at times. So I love the fact that you're working to kind of put the two together in their rightful places.
Yeah. I mean, I think the reason I went into family therapy as opposed to any other kind of discipline of counseling is because I can't see individuals as independent from the people around them and the people in their lives. You know, our families or our formed families are so integral to our well-being and our existence. So yeah, I think we definitely need to talk more about families and what's going on with us. So
absolutely. Couldn't agree more. And so, Jenny, I was kind of going through your bio and remembering some of the things that I learned about you the last time that we got a chance to interact about a year ago through NORD and the Rare in the Family Forum, which was fantastic. And by the way, that was our first real bits of interaction, Jenny, but that's also when I realized you are absolutely 100% legit, because you masterfully kept me in line for the whole session. And that's no small feat. Like, it was an hour long. We were working with Tammy from Arkansas, and she is a pro's pro, but boy, you held me in check. So I was like, all right, yeah, Jenny knows her stuff.
I barely had to do anything. You two really just went with it, and you just shone. It was a wonderful experience, really.
Yeah, same for me. I really enjoyed it. And one of the things that I kind of took away from that was the plethora of work that you've got. You've just got so many wonderful things that you've been doing and you're continuing to do. So I wanted to maybe revisit a little bit of those and kind of discuss how that's led you to where you are now. So you mentioned a little bit of your background there, and you talked about the NIH work. You were doing some work as the psychosocial qualitative research specialist, right? And the mental health clinician on that side. And you did a dissertation that was kind of outlining some of the unique social and psychological needs that families have with a specific rare form of cancer predisposition syndrome, right?
Yeah.
And so with that, I would say that I know that we could have basically a whole conversation about that. I mean, because a whole podcast, you were there for 4 years, right?
Yeah.
And I know we could talk all day about it. If you were to kind of summarize things a little bit about what you found there, maybe put it into an elevator speech or a nutshell a little bit. That's probably really hard to do, Jenny, but if you could do that, how would you summarize those things?
That was my first real exposure to how devastating sometimes rare disease can be and how deeply it impacts family systems. The specific syndrome that I was working with, it was called Lee-Fermini syndrome, high rates of cancer, high rates of death from cancer. And so, you know, I was doing interviews with people who had lost not just one, but multiple people to this condition, and then trying to figure out, you know, for the next generation, what the best decisions were for reducing their risk. So it really hit home for me how much these conditions really can take a toll on people's mental health. And so not only was I doing interviews with those families, but I was also doing sometimes kind of assessments to see, you know, are they doing all right? Do we need to kind of refer them to more intensive mental health support? And so that was really like my kind of big takeaway from that work. But my dissertation was a little more focused. It was looking at couple relationships and couple dynamics. So I was looking at when there was one person who had Lee-Fermini syndrome and the partner did not. How did that kind of influence their relationship, their roles as parents, as partners? And also, how did they create kind of a shared identity in the face of this challenging condition? I think sometimes parents especially focus a lot on the children, but the parental relationship is also very, very important. And so that was why I wanted to focus my dissertation on that relationship. And it was really, found some really interesting things that I think, you know, are both unique to Lee-Fermini syndrome, but also can be applied to many different conditions as well.
Yeah, and that's what I was a little bit curious about also, is how can we kind of extrapolate some of that data perhaps, or maybe find some you know, some possible overlap with folks who have a separate or a different rare disease. If you had a couple of those kind of takeaways that you feel like might be applicable elsewhere, what might you say for those areas?
Yeah, I think one interesting thing that I found was this concept, and it wasn't unique, like I wasn't the first one to figure this out, about protective buffering, which is like when you, out of love and compassion and caring for your partner or your children or people around you, you try not to disclose or tell them too much about what's going on for you and your tough emotions. But I actually found that to be kind of detrimental to their relationships, and they really wished that their partners had opened up to them more about what was going on for them. And they found, you know, I remember a couple of people who eventually went to like couples therapy or something like that and were able to learn how to communicate about those hard emotions. You know, they felt so much closer after that. Yeah. They felt so much less separate from each other. They were more in it together. So I think that's something when we often are trying to spare the emotions of our loved ones, we're sometimes doing them a disservice, you know? So I think that was a really important thing that came out of that work. And then another one was just, you know, the importance. And we talked about this at NORD was, you know, all the different hats that you have to wear and all the different roles that you have to do. It's important. I found that the couples that really were coping the best were the ones that had really distinct and clear roles in how they managed their condition and their children's health and that kind of thing. So one of them would be like, you know, I'm the one who does all the medical records stuff. Like I keep track of all that. I make all the appointments. And the other one's like, I'm the one who talks to the kids because I feel more comfortable doing that, you know? And so because they had so much going on, it was really helpful for them to kind of divvy up and play to their strengths.
Very helpful and interesting perspective that is backed up by the research. And that's always nice to have as well. I feel like for me and for my wife, we almost naturally, especially for that second point there, fall into those categories. And I think for me, I'd be the one who talks to the kids, right? And that's because it's my background. I mean, that's my trade, right? Like I went to, you know, I did my undergraduate and elementary education, and then I did my graduate degrees in education as well. So that's an interesting dichotomy that we didn't necessarily talk about that or plan that out, but that's kind of how it has fallen. And I think maybe to take the next step, it might be a situation where we do define things a little bit more, make the unspoken spoken. That, you know, I think that maybe ties in a little bit more with your first point there about the communication aspects, because I can relate to that part as well. It is really a challenge at times, especially when you see the stress that comes with being the one, in my case, who has the rare disease, who's going through, you know, the challenging medical dynamics and all that comes with that. It impacts your spouse, your loved one. It impacts your kids. And there is that tendency sometimes often to shield some of those, you know, those feelings, those thoughts in order to protect.
Definitely. I'm so glad you shared that. I found that it was happening not on just the side of the person who had the condition, but also, I mean, both sides, you know.
Sure.
I think the person with the condition didn't already felt like they, you know, were maybe overburdening sometimes or wanting to not try to add too much to their partner's stress. And then similarly, you know, on the other side, the other person just didn't know how to talk to the spouse. They didn't always have the same level of familiarity with the language, or, you know, just didn't know. They were like, you're already facing this illness, you know, why would I want to dump my feelings on you too? So I totally get it. And I think there are times in which, you know, it may be useful to practice that. But I think what I found is that in general, people want the partners wanted them to share it with them.
Yes. And I think I bring this up on conversation or when I'm talking to other folks in the community. Dr. Mark Brackett's work on permission to feel is so incredibly powerful and important. And one of the things that I do take away from that is that, you know, I've got all my emotions, I've got all my feelings, I need to give myself the permission to feel that. And I also need to make sure that I'm giving others permission to feel as well, because they're going through those same, you know, those same emotions, or I mean, in their own way, right? But like, they're also experiencing things, I guess is a better way to say it. So yeah, I appreciate you bringing up that side of it as well.
Mm-hmm.
So with mental health being so, you know, important, and I really appreciate the work that you're doing there, And particularly, you're bringing the culturally competent piece to the forefront, which is so important. And, you know, as we're talking here, I wonder how kind of the research that you're doing, the work that you do on a daily basis, how does that impact you? How does that impact your mental health? And are you able to, you know, make sure that you're taking care of yourself as well through all this? Because that's got to be pretty heavy.
It's probably one of the first lessons we learn as therapists is how to, you know, be really present with our clients' emotions, what's going on for them, but also trying to learn to put that in a box and move on with our other tasks. And it's not always easy, right? I think for some situations, it's a little easier. For some of the research projects I've done, it's been a little harder. Like I would say the interviews that I did with the families with Lieber-Meany syndrome, after I finished those sometimes 2 hour long sessions with those family members, I would go and cry in my car, you know, Like it was really hard. And there was, you know, not much that I could unfortunately do to help them because my interaction was one session a year with them. It wasn't an ongoing therapeutic relationship. So yeah, it can be really heavy sometimes, but I think one of the ways that we deal with that in my field is having a supervisor, having a solid group of colleagues around you so that you can debrief, get feedback. So I am very lucky to have that. I have great supervision and I have great therapy colleagues that I speak to when I need to.
Well, I'm sure glad that that's the case. And I think that that's something that the rest of us can also take into account as well, building those solid support teams and having those folks that are around us on a continual basis or a more regular basis than we might be seeing our mental health specialists in the field with our visits there is a really important part. And kind of with that piece, Jenny, I was curious if you agree with that assessment that I just kind of made up on my own. and second, if you have any other, you know, recommendations for, you know, what you've kind of seen from that mental health side that we might be able to apply ourselves in the situation, like for me as a parent with a rare disease or for other families that might not be parents that could be listening, but that, you know, where the rare disease has impacted them and their lives.
I'm fortunate in a way that my profession requires that I have this kind of consultation with a supervisor or this debrief. This is part of our not just training until we become, you know, a little bit more experienced, but ongoing education and learning. I think if more, honestly, health professionals had that kind of built-in structural support, it would be a great way to address burnout. And, you know, if you can apply that to anybody, really, like, I think we all deserve to have more set in place support for ourselves, whether that is a therapist or whether it's a support group or whether it's, you know, just good friends. But, you know, when I had my supervision group, it was every month we would meet once a month and I always looked forward to it and I always knew that I had it. And so I think that is really something I actually need to learn to be better about as a parent too. Right?
Yeah.
So yeah, I totally agree. But I think as far as, you know, parents with rare disease or with children with rare diseases, knowing when you need that extra support is really important. And honestly, my threshold for going to therapy is super low. I truly believe that everybody should have a therapist. Everybody deserves that opportunity to talk freely to someone without being worried about being judged or how they need to manage that other person's emotions, just to be themselves and to work through whatever they have going on. So I really think if you can get one, to get a therapist. But I think especially for parents who, you know, have signs that they are maybe not doing as well as they used to be, I think that's when coping mechanisms from before maybe just aren't making you feel any better. Or if you're feeling really down, struggling to kind of get basic tasks done, I think those are things that you need to pay attention to and probably try to get some support with.
Absolutely. It's challenging. And I can speak from my own experience, Jenny, of being the person in that seat where I started to recognize a little bit, okay, I might need a little more help here. I might need a little more support here. I'm struggling or I'm not doing well at all. And that's in addition to the physical side, right? The mental side really can take its toll. And for me, you know, for a myriad of reasons, I'm sure I resisted. I didn't want anything to do with that. I, you know, at the time, if I just, you know, throw it all out there, I'm like, I don't need that. You know, there's a stigma attached to it. Am I admitting at that point in time that I am weak, that I am, you know, caving in, giving in, succumbing to, you know, these pressures, and I'm not strong enough to handle it? And it took me a series of steps. I mean, I joke, I took baby steps. You've got a 2-year-old right now, you know, like you can remember vividly those days when they're starting to figure out, can I get up? Can I do this on my own? I fall back down, get back up a step at a time or two, right? That, I mean, that was me, except I didn't quite have the same persistence or perseverance as the little ones do when they're going after it. It was a struggle every step of the way. It was, man, that card that my PCP gave me is sitting there staring at me in the face. I'm going to put that under the pile for a while, right? Like, yeah, I know that card's still there. I'll get it out and look at it. And then I'll dial the phone number, but not hit, you know, not hit the call button. Oh, they didn't answer. I tried, you know, it didn't work. It was just this whole process. And so I guess what I would say for anybody that might be, you know, listening, that is experiencing some of those things, is, you know, recognize that you're experiencing all those things. Give yourself some empathy and understanding, because it is a big step. It is a big decision to make. And it's also totally worth it when you can do that. And it's important to do that rather than to kind of shove things aside, I guess. Are you available to recommend any resources for folks that might be wondering where to go and how to find somebody or start this journey themselves, especially if they weren't somebody as, you know, privileged as I was to be able to have the support and have somebody recommend a specific plan and route for me to take?
Yeah, it's really helpful when you can get those direct recommendations. You know, sometimes your primary care provider has specific people in mind that they know are, you know, have had good experiences with. You can call your insurance or look on your insurance's website and see who's covered by your insurance, because I think, you know, cost is definitely a consideration for a lot of people. One of my favorite resources is psychologytoday.com. They have a therapist locator, and you can search. I think this is so great. You can search by, you know, insurance coverage, but also by like topic area, you know, what you want to talk about. And I believe they do have something like chronic illness or medical therapy or something like that in there. You can search by language. You know, it's really a great tool. And then it'll, you know, search your zip code and tell you like where they're at and how to connect with those people. And then also word of mouth. You know, I think, although you don't want to have like your best friend's therapist, maybe somebody in the same practice may have the same kind of values and approach to therapy that may mesh well with you. Because I think something that is really, really important is how you connect to your therapist. Finding somebody that, this is actually, there's a lot of research to show that one of the biggest predictors of kind of success or meeting the goals of therapy is the relationship between the therapist and the client. And so I think it's not that easy to get a therapist, but once you get there, you know, don't just settle. You know, I think if you are starting to feel like, yeah, maybe this isn't a great fit in the first couple of sessions, you know, you can be very open with your therapist and tell them that and ask them to refer you to other people. They are legally obligated to give you a referral. So yeah, I would say that that's something really important to consider. Yeah. I always try to remind myself or remind my clients to treat ourselves with the same compassion that we have for our loved ones.
Well, that's wonderful advice. And I was about to say that exact same thing, Jenny. We are on the same page with that, because we're our own worst critics oftentimes, and we will not treat ourselves the way that we would treat somebody else. And, you know, just in a lot of the relationships and things that I've been able to develop in this kind of short time of being in the rare disease space and making connections with other folks, I just recognize how supportive the environment is. And when you put it in that light of, hey, with the other people in your support group, with the other people in your household, other people in your family and your friends groups, like, that's not what they would tell you, man. They would tell you to go get the help that you need, and I'm here to support you through it every step of the way. And just because you're doing this does not in any way acknowledge weakness, but in turn, it would be a strength, right? And to be able to give ourselves that grace that we would give to others is incredibly important. and challenging.
It's so hard. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing those resources. Those are fantastic pointers for folks. And, you know, I know that that's been something that I was able to glean from our previous conversations and be able to share with some other folks at times as well. And I would encourage everybody to look into that if need be. So, Jenny, one of the areas that you're kind of focusing on now, if I'm correct, is the families kind of undergoing genetic testing for those inherited health conditions, right? And along that regard, I don't know how well my scenario matches up with yours, but I know that with the scenarios that you're researching, I know that with me and with some other folks that I've come in contact with in the community, whether it's my mitochondrial disease community or the rare disease community, chronic illness community at large, those genetic testings can be quite a mixed bag. It's been a part of my process, but a secondary part. I had a clinical diagnosis for my mitochondrial disease, and we subsequently did genetic testing a couple of different forms at a couple of different times, and they've only revealed variants of uncertain significance. VUS, and I'm sure those three letters resonate with some that are listening here. I know it was really a challenge for me. Is there anything that you have in mind that you try to, you know, maybe focus on or bring to the forefront in terms of helping folks cope with that lack of information, if that makes sense?
Yeah, that is such a huge theme in the work that I'm currently doing, and especially, you know, that three-letter word, VUS. How frustrating. I mean, and you know, for certain populations too, that VUS, it comes up even more for people who are underrepresented in the genetic databases as well. So that's something that I'm working on. But I think what you're talking about is kind of like the lack of answers, right? That uncertainty. I've definitely seen this with the folks that I've been working with at the Undiagnosed Diseases Network, because I think they're diagnosis rate with whole genome exome sequencing is still under 50%. So there's still a lot of people who go through this really rigorous examination, but they still don't have a diagnosis. That is not to say that within their few years of participating that they didn't find something later on. There is value, and I'm biased because I'm a researcher, but there is value in doing these types of tests not just once, but multiple times, especially over time. This is such a rapidly developing field. The way that data is being integrated nowadays is really strengthening the way that we can look at populations across the globe, right? So maybe I've seen quite a few instances in which people have ultra rare diseases where there's maybe only two or three known cases. One is maybe in the US, the other is somewhere in Eastern Germany or something, you know, like, mm-hmm. or Eastern Europe or something like that.
Right.
But even in that case, they're able to connect through these research consortiums. Yes, it is disappointing. I think you can still hold a little bit of hope. People try. I hear oftentimes people say, I don't want to hold too much hope. I didn't go into this having very much hope. But I think like we have to kind of be honest with ourselves. Like, this wouldn't be hard if we didn't have some kind of hope, right? Because that's what leads us to feel disappointed. What is important to focus on, I think, is what we have control over, right? And that is how we manage our symptoms, how we continue to get quality care for the things that we do know how to manage. I think that's really where I've seen a lot of families just kind of focus their efforts. I've even seen people say, like, a genetic diagnosis for us didn't really matter because we're managing our symptoms really well. You know, even if we don't know what the condition is, like, we still have the resources, we're doing okay, you know, that kind of thing. But I also have heard a lot of people say, I think there was a great phrase that I heard from somebody that was like, genetics just hasn't caught up to where I'm at or something like that. You know, where genetics is still catching up.
Yeah. Yeah. Instead of like looking at it as if I'm not doing something right, it's like, hey, the science isn't there yet. And I love that yet word going in there. As hard as it is at times, we just want some answers, and that would be great. It would be really helpful because that means we're moving things forward a little bit. That yet piece does kind of help keep that hope alive and help it keep going, help it keep moving forward.
I actually just wanted to add one thing to that, actually, because And I don't want to generalize too much because I'm working with a very specific group, but we did just publish a paper about people's, the kind of benefits that they got out of whole genome sequencing or whole exome sequencing. And the benefits were, very few were actually clinical. A lot of the benefits were kind of psychological or social. So they found that if they were able to get a diagnosis, then they were able to connect with people who had that same condition. Their clinical care didn't very often change very much, to be honest. So yeah. I think that's something to keep in mind as well. The psychological benefits of, again, kind of having that answer was really nice. So I think that's, you know, there's many ways to think about what a diagnosis would do or what the results of a genetic test would do. So I just wanted to kind of broaden our viewpoint of that.
Well, I appreciate that. That stems off of a couple of conversations that I've recently had as well with some folks. And I felt the same way before as well. Well, let's say the genetic testing does come back. It's not going to change a thing right now. It's still going to be, yeah, we're going to just manage the symptoms the best that we can. But I can see that psychological impact being a positive because, I mean, again, I'll just speak from my perspective, for my journey in terms of diagnosing mitochondrial disease, the preferred route that the doctors are taking now is genetic. And I was diagnosed through a muscle biopsy, which is kind of the older science, the way they used to do things before. And honestly, there's times where that impacts me on the psychological or the mental health side as well, because I almost get this sense or feeling of imposter syndrome, where it's like, well, yeah, I've got this, but I don't have that. Ultimately, it's really not going to change a whole lot or anything just yet, right? Like, I know that one thing for me is if I were able to get some of that genetic confirmation instead of the variants of unknown significance where we're not quite sure yet, I could access clinical trials, which I'm not able to do right now because of it. So there are many layers. There's folks that I've talked to on both sides where they're like, yeah, what's the point? It's not going to do anything for me. And others where they're like, hey, I'm not really sure, including myself, but maybe that can help move the science forward. Maybe just having those things out there will help. And then eventually some of these variants that we're not so sure about can be, you know, learned more about the further we go along. And I also, you know, one other little sidebar that I'm just thinking about here is especially like, how can we get genetic testing to be more widely available to some of the underserved populations to, you know, I mean, it is so expensive. And again, I am just, I'm so privileged and as difficult and as challenging it as it is, you know, I'm a 37-year-old white male and I've had a lot of things afforded to me and I'm not, you know, negligent of that. I recognize it. And there's also some luck in there that is probably tied into it. But one of my genetic, you know, testings that came available just happened to be because my geneticist was given an opportunity through a university to look into a new whole genome sequencing process. You know, if it weren't for that, I probably still wouldn't have very many resources to get out there unless you really dig and go and find. But how do we take that next step? And I'm not asking you to give me the answer right now, Jenny. Maybe you have thoughts on it, but maybe, man, I don't know. Maybe we need to keep pounding the drum, I guess. I don't really know. I don't know what the answer is there.
I think advocacy groups are amazing, you know, and I think people like yourself and others speaking up about your experiences is really important. But I also think a lot of this is on the healthcare system and on this new area of healthcare, which is genetics, right? It is a relatively new field, and there's a lot of different areas in medicine that have done great work increasing accessibility to their services. Genetics is still working on it, for sure. This is right now a huge area of my interest, and how can we reduce those barriers? How can we facilitate this for families who don't speak English, who are not familiar to this healthcare system, who are pretty resistant to talking about it with family members or strangers, right? So this is definitely what I'm working on. And I think something that I just will share one piece of something that's not published yet, but I'm really excited about it that has come out of my work with the UDN is some of the Spanish-speaking folks that I worked with were saying that they had such gratitude for their providers. You know, you mentioned your geneticist. I think that these providers have a really important role to play, right? So getting word out to those key people about those different clinical trials, about those opportunities so that they can then pass on the information to their patients is super, super important. It's kind of like lots of different steps, but I think we are starting to know how to address some of those issues and increase access for sure. Insurance is always a struggle.
Right.
But yeah, I think, you know, they're genetic counselors. I work with a lot of genetic counselors, and I think they're a wonderful resource in not just talking to you about the condition, your concerns, answering questions about that, but also dealing with insurance companies too. They have a lot of knowledge. So yeah, they're a great resource.
Well, that's encouraging, like to hear you kind of summarize some of those things and talk about the work that you're doing. It gives me a little extra pep in my step, which I can always use, right? Like to just know that you're out there leading the charge, Jenny, is good news for all of us. And I, you know, once again, want to just commend you for that work and thank you for the work that you're doing there. So Jenny, one of the most difficult things for me as a parent who's diagnosed, and you mentioned this a little bit earlier, that oftentimes, you know, somebody that might be in my situation, a spouse and a dad, you know, family guy, and now had to transition out of my role in education. And it's just a complete, you know, turned upside down life, right? But one of the things that I really find, and it was really the impetus for, you know, getting this podcast going, is being a dad. It's just such a challenge. And, you know, for those of us that are parents who are diagnosed with a rare disease, chronic illness, those corresponding conversations with the children can be just brutal, like really, really hard, really difficult. And one of the things that I immediately thought of when I sat in the doctor's office and got the diagnosis, right? So I'm curious with your work in, you know, in family health and all the work that you've done here, any advice or tips or pointers for folks to, you know, to lean on a little bit when we have been going through those situations? It seems like for me, there's almost phases of it, right? Like the first time when symptoms roll in, and then you're on the diagnostic odyssey, and then after a diagnosis or the situation we just talked about, you don't get a diagnosis, just more questions. Like any perspective you can lend for those of us that are kind of going through those types of situations and needing to talk with our kiddos about it?
I have a couple of ideas. I mean, and these again come from people that I've talked to like you. The first, I think, is oftentimes the weightiness of those conversations has more to do with the fear and the emotions of the parents rather than the children. And this is not to minimize these conversations, but kids are very resilient. And I think the families that I've talked to that have been like, oh, I haven't told my child about this, or, you know, we don't know how to talk about it. It is really about the parents' fear and anxiety. And so I think something that's really important to keep in mind is to work on how you're going to kind of manage your own emotions regarding your condition or regarding those conversations, right? Because I think where we get into some trouble is when the children feel like they need to regulate their parents' emotions, right?
Yes.
And that's when we start to become a little concerned. But I think, you know, if you are in touch with what's going on with yourself, if you're working on getting those resources for yourself, then your children will really, really value having an open line of communication. Somebody that they know that they can go to with questions that they won't have to worry about later. You know, like they feel like it doesn't really matter what's going on. I can always ask them, and I won't be afraid to ask them. I think that's where our emotion regulation comes into play a lot. I think, again, I can't emphasize enough that kids are resilient and they're super stinking smart. So even if you don't tell them something's going on, they can most likely sense that something is going on. And so it's better for you to be upfront with them, because just imagine what their imagination is coming up with, right? It's probably much, much worse than the actual situation. So yeah, that would be some of my advice.
Yeah. And that's such an important perspective to have, because you are so right. The antennas are always up. They've got this like sixth sense. Like, even if you're trying not to, you know, lead on or anything, they know. They can tell. Yeah. And then, you know, I guess for me, one of the things that's been pretty helpful is trying to, and I think, again, this leans back onto my you know, my schooling, my education, and the amount of time that I've just spent around kids, you know, in a professional setting. And I've always been, you know, been one to spend time with kids in the classroom or on the athletic fields, but figuring out a way to approach it in child-friendly terms, child-friendly language, right? We don't have to throw the whole kitchen sink at them, but they, like you said, they're smart. They know, and they can, you know, you can get into it a little bit and tell them what, you know, what you need to, and not be afraid of it while not also overburdening or overbearing them with everything. Might be a little bit of a balance sometimes, but it's important.
And I think one thing that I've recommended that's kind of more specific and concrete that I think is helpful is, you know, the concept of family meetings, which we're probably familiar with, but that regular time that we know that will be a time that people can raise concerns of any kind, right? That really, I think, has people who have been able to put that into place. Parents can get on the same page beforehand about what they want to communicate, maybe practice it with each other, and then go into that meeting a little prepared and talk about it as a whole family. Or if kids have something they want to bring up, then that's their opportunity to bring up. They know that there's this time on Monday nights or whenever it is that I'll be able to talk to my parents. So I think that's been, when I've made that suggestion and people have been able to implement it, you know, it does take some work for sure to like have a regular meeting, get everybody together and have focused attention for whatever. Like,
No squirrels. Yeah.
Yeah. But it is helpful. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for sharing those ideas. And before we start to wrap up here, Jenny, I was just curious if there's any other advice or resources along these topics, or maybe even something else that you kind of had in mind when we started discussing, you know, our conversation here focused around parents is rare, but then hopefully it's more or helpful and applicable for everybody in the community as well. Anything else that you can think of or that we haven't brought up yet to chat about that you wanted to share with everybody before we wrap up?
This isn't necessarily specific to rare disease, but just given where we are at in this global pandemic and given everything that everybody has going on, something that I have been holding close is to every day find one thing that brings you joy, no matter what that is. And I think, you know, we talk about trying to exercise and, you know, eat well and do all the things and take care of ourselves, but just one small thing that brings you joy, whether that's observing your kids do something, whether that's, you know, a long embrace with your partner, whether that's just standing outside in the sun, you know, just one thing each day that brings us joy. I think focusing on that is important.
Absolutely. Yeah. Find that joy. Hold on to it. Love that. Wonderful advice. Last thing, where can we find you, Jenny? Where can folks find you? Social media, websites? You don't have to give out your cell phone number or anything, but we want to know, where can we find you? This has been great.
You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Dr. Jenny Young, Jenny with an I. You can also feel free to email me. My email is youngjl@stanford.edu. If they have contact with you, they can probably also be forwarded along to me. Yeah.
Yep, absolutely. You can always reach out to me and I can get you in touch with Jenny. But she's been a fabulous resource for me and a wonderful help to others in the community. So glad that our paths have crossed. Jenny, thanks for all that you do. It's really incredible, valuable work that's so incredibly important. And I'm excited to see where you go and all the wonderful things that you'll continue to do. And I appreciate your time today. Thanks so much for joining.
Absolutely. And Adam, you are amazing. I am so glad you're doing this and doing all your work as well. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Parents is Rare, a series of the Energy in Action podcast. Please be sure to leave a review and a rating for this episode wherever you listen, and subscribe and listen to the Energy in Action podcast, where we talk all things Mito. Until next time, remember to show up, be vulnerable, supportive, and kind, and give yourself permission to feel along the way.